Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight, another very interesting show on a subject that I actually haven't specifically done a show on before. And this subject may arouse some, we'll say, even hostile feelings in some people who may not be on the same, we'll say, have the same ideas about what I'm going to be talking about, and may not have the same feelings and thoughts about God. But at any rate, tonight's show is on atheism, a world of misery without God. And mostly what I'm going to be emphasizing in tonight's show isn't so much about the good or bad of atheism as a chosen structure of understanding and or belief in there being no such thing as God. And that is the premise that people who are atheists generally hold. It isn't so much about that question as it is about where it comes from, what in terms of ageless wisdom and, we'll say, the esoteric parts of psychology, which, of course, I'm these days talking more about, and also what it leads to in terms of the function of our world or any world, and beyond that, what is the alternatives for people who have such a view, because after all, people don't necessarily wake up one day and just say, gee, I'm going to be an atheist just because it sounds good. Most people come to this conclusion because, in at least the beginning of the process, the majority of people come to it by a condition that I call rational thought. And that's generally not considered a bad thing to have rational thought. Now, in the minority, people are atheists because they witness or see things that are so atrocious and have such terrible consequences for life that they conclude there couldn't be a God that would make such a thing. So this show also is for those folks because there needs to be an explanation of why such a thing could be. And then beyond that, there are those who choose atheism in a much more sinister way. They do so because they are seeking to gain at the cost of others for various reasons, sometimes because they are caught in a material belief structure, and worse than that, they may also have, we'll say, a criminal type of personality, which would be a serious disorder of sorts. And sometimes they seek to hurt others or destroy the self of others as well. Criminals do this, but when it's the dominant part of their problem, then they'd be more like a sociopath, which is another kind of personality disorder. And then finally, you have some folks who are atheists who are just actually evil. Now, this is a bizarre kind of way I'm going to explain this. We're going to get into all this. But I'm starting off with the basic, as I usually do, definitions and trying to define things in the most general ways possible. And there's a group of people who are small in number that are atheists, at least to the outside world they are, because they are evil. Now, that's a weird kind of position to be in. Not all people who are evil profess to be atheists. Some of them profess to be highly religious when actually they are not religious, but they also aren't atheists either. They believe in God in some respects, but they believe God is weaker than, worse than, less than they, at least as a collective group of people, and they may be as individuals. I know that sounds a little strange, but that's a fact. Now I'll explain that at some point during the show. So we have all of these different classifications of atheism, and I think we'll start where I just started, which was, how does someone in, we'll say, with a reasonable level of rational thinking believe that there is no such thing as God? Well, as I've explained in prior shows, human beings are unique compared to other life forms at and below their level because, there is no other life form that has a direct sense of their own creator that is less than human. Really, that's the truth. Now, an animal that is a pet and is a higher level mammal could, and sometimes does, gain some small sense of God. They get it from their masters, us, the people that are closest to them. And those animals get it because they have a fully developed heart and crown chakra as part of their bodies. And that's unusual for any animal to have. But if it's developed enough, then if it's informed by consciousness, which they don't have, and they can gain some of that consciousness through interactions with humans, then they could slightly have an understanding of God. But generally, animals don't, and humans do. Now, why is that? Because our heart and crown chakras, the senses we have that come to us from them, are fully informed by our consciousness in most people. Now, there's some exceptions to this because you can damage that level of consciousness in various ways by disordering your personality and creating a lot of destruction to the conscious part of yourself, the self. And as the self shrinks, one of the first areas it's threatened in losing touch with, losing sense of, is God. Now, why would that happen? Well, because it's the most difficult sense that of all the hierarchy of senses that we have, that a person, an animal, any life form can have up to human beings. So it's the most difficult to develop, the most complete to keep. And when you start shrinking yourself, either because you have a psychotic disease that we talk about, you know, we talk about emotional development problems, but also psychosis is a mental disease of sorts. And as you shrink the self, I have a program I did about that for you a few weeks ago. As you shrink the self, you lose first contact with your sense of God. Now, this can present a series of serious difficulties because the sense of God is what gives us the ability to be creative with another, we'll say, resultant ability called hope. What is hope? Hope comes from faith in something greater than yourself, and therefore that the outcome of things are not dependent just upon the ability of yourself, self being the conscious part of us, to resolve all problems that you face in life. Okay? I know I'm going fast. We will cover more of this later in the show, but you can also re-listen to this. You have that option. I don't have the option to make a longer show, so I've got to kind of get as much in as I can get while getting as good, as they say. So please stay with me. Okay. So here you go. Let's say that one more time, because, boy, that probably flew by some people. Okay. We've got a self, and a self is the conscious part of us. It informs, the consciousness informs, the two senses of the heart chakra, which is being conscious of God, and the crown chakra, which is being able to actually co-create with God. In other words, we can become a co-creator of virtue, because that virtue is light in form, with God. We can actually do that. And we start losing that sense first. The very first sense we tend to lose when our self is shrinking, even by a small margin, is we lose our sense of creating the part of ourself that is informed from the crown chakra, which tells us how to create more virtue in the world. Wow. Anything that might be enlightening to the world as whole entity of a world, which helps other people, other life, the planet in general, that all of that we could do shrinks and is first affected or diminished by diminishment of ourselves. Now, as it progresses, and that's the first step, we're called, towards losing a sense of God, then the second loss of sense of God comes from, and it's more serious there, comes from losing the heart chakra in a conscious way. So your sense of being conscious of God, like being able to say, oh, God's in that, God's over there. And part of the expression of God in form is beauty. So things become less and less beautiful to people who start losing that sense. As they lose that sense, they've already most of the time lost significant amounts of the crown chakra sense. So those two senses, that they are getting lost, the person completely is losing both of the senses then of God, and is therefore, at this juncture now, unable to have hope, because hope is the ability to believe that something's greater than ourselves, and that is greater than the selves of other people as well, because once our self fails in numerous ways, we start losing confidence in other selves. And so we have a wayward, even erratic personality that will react with the self we have left to others with doubt and disbelief. So you have all that going on because you don't have faith in God, which would give you hope. And hope is a critical element, because when you don't, because it's inevitable that human beings fail because their self is relatively weak, and our ability to understand or be conscious, which is relative to the size of our self, is also weak. And that causes us to then become fearful of the life we're in, and the most important fear we have is further and vastly exaggerated once we lose these two senses of God, and that fear is the fear of death. It grows exponentially as we lose our sense of God. And people who are fully, we'll call it atheistic, they have no belief in God, and therefore, you could almost say ipso facto, which means it's automatically true to that, to us anyway, they don't believe it. They don't have a sense of God. Then the result is that they have an enormous fear of death. Now, the odd part about this, and I'm going to say this with a little bit of, you know, humility, because some people say, well, how do you know this to be true? I'm going to explain as best as I can, and I'm pretty well convinced it's true, but I leave it open to anybody to disagree with me, of course. The odd part about this is that as people who are atheistic drop in their sense of God, or reduce in their sense of God, and therefore aren't conscious even that God exists in any way, they do employ rational thought, but there's another word that they do, which has the same word in it, and that's rationalize. They use the rational thought they have to make up any kind of reason they can come up with, no matter how complex or how, we'll say, difficult to contrive, that whatever is taking place doesn't require the existence of God. Doesn't require. And you reach a point where it's called reductio absurdum, where it becomes almost into, almost anybody would have a hard time believing the level that someone has to invent about everything they experience to come up with that there is no God. Now, how do they do this? They do it by limitation of thought. And science and some parts of science, like medicine, but other parts as well, is very good at doing this. It limits or reduces the thought using what is known as fifth ray kind of structure to the point where the person using the thought believes there's an answer to every question. Even if you don't have the answer yet, you will find it eventually. And it's always something that is a material and tangible, and we can mathematically and we can whatever figure the whole thing out. And therefore, God is not needed because there is a reason for all things. And this kind of rationalization, which comes from excessive use of rational thought only, produces a unique kind of person, unique in the sense that it has almost any underpinnings, inevitably, of the person having a self which itself is limited by the same level that the person limits their thinking to. It's a very strange kind of proposition. So, in other words, the self is created. Myself, I'll use me as an example. Myself is created. It's self-created. It creates itself by generating in its creations explanations for the entire world, including, in my case, there is a God, if I can sense it in two different ways, and I can experience it in numerous other ways, including beauty, which is what I said is one of the expressions of God in this world. But I can also see truth and love and the coordination of activities to help other people and other things to become more efficient and lack forces. I can sense all that, and I can sense the forces that happen when those things aren't happening. So I can have all that as a sense, and I can say, well, this is something that is the expression of something greater than I am, because I myself can't do it all alone by myself. But regardless, I can do that. That doesn't mean everybody has to buy into what I'm saying. But nonetheless, in those who come up with these, we'll call it rationalizations or rational thoughts, that God doesn't have to exist and therefore does not exist because there's no reason for its existence, right? They do a strange thing to themselves in the process, but it's also because of their self that it's happening. So one thing feeds back to the other. And the thing they do is they limit themselves. They reduce themselves continuously by this kind of thought. It also gives them comfort as their thought is shrinking, as their self is thinking. They also get a little bit of comfort, actually, into believing that it isn't actually their self that's thinking. It's just that they're coming to this new realization that the world is just a bunch of chaos and nuts and bolts and things, and there's no need for a God. Too bad, so sad, but there isn't one. And other people are just deluded into believing so. It has a very challenging, even seriously negative effect on the self of these folks. They may, of course, hide it, and of course, unlikely to admit it. But the point I'm trying to make is that just adopting atheism through one's rational thinking has a serious debilitating effect on the development of self. Now, the self, as I've been talking about, is really the part of us that makes us more like God than anything else. Diminishing ourselves gives us further proof that God must not exist because we are less and less like God, and therefore it's harder for us to see that which we are not like. And again, the process begins with this rational thinking. It usually has two sides to it, and I'll try to explain these in less technical terms. For the few of you who know something about what I've written about the mental mind, people who have trouble, let's say, because of rational thinking and rationalization of thinking about God, they start off usually being able to think somewhat personally, spiritually about God. What does that mean? That as long as there's something in it for them, they're willing to give to others, even if they no longer believe that God exists. They still, as an atheist, want to participate in giving to others because it feels good. They can still sense some element of love in them and love in others. And so the result is that although they may not believe in God, they believe in love. In a personal sense, because they only do it when it makes them feel good, not only to give, but feel good in themselves and about themselves and from themselves. And that feeling of good is at least half the reason why they do it. That doesn't mean the other half isn't important, but it's a very challenging, we'll say, reason for spiritual development. And it's limited to being something that falls below the level of soul giving. It's more personal giving, although the highest levels of personal giving still could be considered godlike in some thought process because it's still spiritual. But it isn't soul-like. All right. Now, for those of you who are familiar, and I doubt very many of you are, with synthetic yoga or any of the parts of the textbook I wrote that explain, you know, life's in meaning, explains the mental body in fine detail, this means that the spiritual part of the mind and the higher part of the third part of the mind, the third tier of the mind, that part is where people who are atheists usually start. They start questioning and reducing their ability to understand God because they lose their sense of soul, which, and that includes the soul or angel, and they may only have a reduced sense of the very first sense that they get from the soul or angel, which is having a conscience. So the conscience is somewhat less, and there's they may try to keep some degree of balance between personally giving and personally receiving, between feeling love in themselves and helping others to feel love. So it's sort of like everything is in this compromise realm, many times it's hypocritical. But regardless, at least it's better than nothing. And that's where atheism really begins. That's the first stage, we'll call it. And it comes mostly from still rational thinking. But the rational thinking is strongly tied to desires to receive as much as you're giving. So, and it's common monastic thought. And so people who are in this event are seduced more easily by evil, find themselves in a process in which they seek to control as much as they seek to love others. So on the one side, sure, they'll give, but provided they can still control other people. And control is really a desire to receive something. So that's where the control and desire to receive kind of join together. All right, so that's where the first part comes from. Now, it gets worse, because the second part of this continues with the rationalization process, but instead of the rational mind trying to balance itself, at least that you give as much as you get or something like that, you start wanting more and more in a deliberate sense and giving less. You may still give on occasion. Or I may say, well, it won't be me, but someone still might give on occasion. But they definitely are, the propensity is to try to get much more than is received. That's the more, we'll call it, incipient and dangerous problem with people who, the slippery slope of atheism, people who are still in the rational part of it, but are now doing so with a vigor of wanting to receive significantly more than they get. And once in a while, they may do good things for people. They may even be philanthropic at certain periods in their life. But they do so only in a very narrow sense and do so only at certain small amounts of relative time and effort, whereas the major part of their life isn't actually taken. All right. So those are the two stages of the rational side. Now, that's just to define that part. Now, what about people who start developing more significant elements of personality disorder, which means the personality needs to be even over-controlling to the self, the person's own self, And then the self starts shrinking even more because of that process. Their sense is to get something for nothing. Not just give and get, but just give, get. You know? And that's when you move from the rational to the, we'll call it, emotional, material-driven person who could become eventually a criminal. But in most circumstances, is just, by our standards in society, mostly an immoral person. But the process then thickens to the level over time that God is not only challenged by rational thinking, but God is challenged because there is this side to the person who sees that God, if God did exist, God is allowing all these bad things to happen. And if God's allowing these bad things to happen, then why not participate in them? Because after all, for one reason or another, God's letting it be. Ah! So it's a deterministic model and a very strange idea. But it's also the denial of God. It's weird. It's the position that if there were a God, then it's a no-good-nick God, so I don't need to really be concerned about my own behaviors, because after all, God's behaviors are as bad as mine. And so that it's also an angry state. There's a hostility about life. People become embittered in this position. Before they become criminals, they're more likely to become autocratic towards others, merciless in some ways, sometimes very wealthy, but at the cost of others, and a disregard for the general welfare, but more a general or specific regard for one's own comfort, one's own betterment in general, and those one cares about, comfort and having the best. So the results are, it is a slippery slope into a position that usually comes from bad life experiences, not just from rational thinking. The rational thinking may come later than the emotional element of a feeling that if God existed, it's a sucky God anyway. And besides which, there's the less than rational side that says, how could God exist if all this crap going on? Come on. What kind of God is that? And so it's a resentful model that also has in it an excuse for almost any behavior. And that's the wonders of live radio. Okay. This is Niles McFlower, again for Wildlife Viz. We had a technical difficulty about 2 minutes before we were due to go to break. The computer, at, not where I'm at, but about 1,000 miles away, froze, and I went off the air for the people who were listening on the computer. Strangely, maybe. The people who are listening on the phone, you know, as you know, you can listen directly over any phone, they kept hearing me. So some of you kept hearing me until the station put on the break a couple minutes early once the computer went down. You heard me for an extra 45 seconds that the other people didn't hear. But let me complete the thought that I was getting to. And then we'll continue on. What we're hoping is that the rest of the show will go smoothly. And if it doesn't, well, we'll just try to do what we can as we can. All right, so the I think I'm going to try to guesstimate where we went down. I was talking about the last of the stages of rational, if we call it that, atheism. And then as we moved from that, I went into the more criminal elements. And then eventually evil. And I think that's where you may have lost me, is the evil point. So the point with evil is that evil takes over for the conscience, evil becomes a conscience, if you want to call it that in a strange kind of substitution way, of a person's higher self. And the person doesn't hear their conscience the way the rest of us hear. They hear this group soul of evil. Well, you can imagine the group soul of evil isn't exactly saying, be kind to others, serve others, do unto others as you would do unto yourself, and furthermore, help others to do the same. I mean, all this, that's not going to be coming through. The message is, get more powerful, get more control over others, become the most forceful, controlling, so that you get what you want whenever you want it. If you want to give to others, that's fine. You can give to others, but make sure you're always on top. And besides which, if you decide you don't want to give, you have the right to completely destroy others. Evil does those things and much more. All right. So all of this has within it, we'll say, the most sinister of behaviors and thoughts. And it certainly in no way represents God, other than the strange issue that I said at the beginning of the show. Evil in some weird, we'll almost call it subconscious ways, believes there is a God. Because after all, you can't want to destroy something that doesn't exist. And it really does want to destroy God. God is life is God's growth, and it does seek to destroy life. So it has a very weird, we'll call it, pretending belief that in atheism, and an even more strange belief about God, that God is something to become greater than. It actually extols the God someday will be defeated by evil, and I don't know how it does that, because there's a logic there. The only way you defeat God is by destroying all life, but the problem is evil is still part of life. So the eventual reduction absurdity of this whole thing is that evil eventually would destroy, it does destroy itself, whether it destroys all of life or not, it will destroy itself either way. Wow, that's a pretty strange position, but it is true. Now, evil doesn't understand that last thing I said. It believes it can destroy God without destroying itself. Go figure. All right, so how come, let's take each one of these stages and look at this from the standpoint of how come we have in the United States 15%+ of the people are atheists. Now, it's plus because even if you take a poll, some people are atheists who don't admit to it, and some people claim to be religious, believe in God or whatever, only because it's a manipulation of sorts, and they won't admit otherwise. So maybe it's closer to 1 in 20, I mean 1 in 5 people, or something like that. So it could be as much as 20% of the population in the United States. Now, because the United States is a first world country, has a lot of well-educated, but even more so, more mentally focused in some circumstances, of the world population living within it. You have, and it used to be in the past, we're more creative than other places for the most part. So you have all this going on here. You would say, well, then atheism should be less, there should be less atheism in the United States, you would think, but that's not true. Because atheism comes from overuse of the lower mind and the lower part of the higher mind, the part that's still personally connected in the process and the soul of understanding concepts. The United States actually has a relatively higher proportion of atheism. Wow. Now, that's some other countries that are not first world countries. And wait, what's going on? How come? Because it's a peculiarity about the human race as it is developed at the present time. we are focused on this part of the mind in terms of our development. And because it's most vulnerable to failing to work properly while it's being developed, that, and this is where we're focused right now, atheism becomes a real scary kind of possibility. It could grow by leaps and bounds in a generation or two, and we're going to talk about that tonight. So it is something to be really seriously concerned about, particularly in first world countries. And the United States has a couple things going for it to prevent it, but at the same time, it has a lot of things that may cause it to grow rapidly in the near future. Whew. Wow. Tell me that isn't a little bit on the fearing side or scary side of things. All right. Let's take it in terms of practical issues. Practically, how does it affect people? Well, people who are atheistic tend to believe that they know better than others. They tend to be egotistical, at minimum, sometimes arrogant. They lack humility because they believe all things can be known or understood. That means they can gain consciousness through knowledge rather than through sense that becomes consciousness of God. They use their senses to gain knowledge, and the knowledge then is used to overpower others and or control others in ways that meets their needs. Now, why do they want to control others if they're not evil? Evil, we know why they want to control and destroy life. But why would they want to control others? Well, because the control gives them a sense, a false sense, of security of their future. And they have a terrible sense of insecurity about their future because they're an atheist. Because they believe that when you die, there is nothing. And if that's true, the death of consciousness is the single greatest fear that the subconscious or personality has. Our subconscious is more afraid of death of consciousness by far than death of body. To lose your body is meaningless to most people. If their consciousness continues in a different body that's easier to live in and has better senses than the physical one, okay, I'll take that deal. You know, that's not so bad. And if you know the consciousness never dies, the only thing that dies are these things we call bodies, and the subconscious dies if it doesn't join with the soul level of consciousness to some extent. And so, I mean, it all depends as far as that's concerned. But most people have the greatest fear of losing their self. And the fear of loss of self is enormous. There's no fear that's even close at the second. Now, this is really hard to understand. Because most people are in, we'll call it, denial about this fear, and particularly if they're an atheist. Why? Because the fear is so vast and huge. Once you commit yourself to believing that there is no God, you have no hope of yourself sustaining anything than a few more years of your life. A few years could be relative, maybe it's a few decades, but it doesn't matter. It's a very small amount of time over the perspective of all eternity. So what is your life meaning if you're going to be here for another 30 years? Nothing. And what if it's only 10 or 15? It's like a blink. And therefore, the meaning in life is gone, and the fear of death is just, it's overwhelming. If you have a disease right now and you have a pretty good idea when you're going to die, well, if you're an atheist, you're going to suffer at endless and grand levels. It's horrible. And the point is it's self-inflicted. The reason it's inflicted by the self is because the self caused it to happen by losing its sense of God. Wow. Some selves, actually, as a person becomes closer to death, gives up its rational position and says, you know what? I'd rather have faith in God, even if God doesn't exist, than to maintain this position because it's intolerable. Well, it's not a terrible, we'll call it, backup position to have. It doesn't solve the problem for them, but it gives some level of comfort. Like, well, maybe if, maybe I, maybe this or that. But the interesting thing is, all the person needs to do is read the textbook I wrote, or there's many other books on the subject of ageless wisdom in general, or you could read the novel I wrote, which is much easier, by the way, and gain a better sense of what life is like after death and why, that may give you some help as well. That all of those things can relieve this really terrible thing. Now, it might take you a year or longer, some people longer, to read a textbook the size of Life's Admini, or it might take a week to read Afterlife Love. But you know what? You could also listen to a lot of these shows. And so, if you're not into reading. But reading is better, and I'll explain that in a second. But the shows have a great benefit in that some people find it tedious to read. Others are not skilled at it. And there's a movement almost to have audiovisual everything. So kind of a problem. Particularly among younger people, because they're being brought up that way. But nonetheless, if you can read, I would strongly suggest you go that route, because this is the reason reading is better. Reading is at your own chosen level of comprehension and understanding. Every word that goes through you at the pace and rate you decide, which builds yourself more. Because every act of reading, every sentence, every word and sentence is an act of creation of more self. Listening is somewhat like that, but not the same. It's not as good. If you're listening and you turn on and off what I'm saying, that can help, but it's still better to read. Because the reading is subconscious, but at the same time, it builds the self. Because the self chooses to start learning, understanding, becoming more conscious. Every second, the process is taking part within the mind, not the brain, within the mind of the reader. So reading has real tremendous benefits compared to listening to these shows, or if we had a big film to show you, or watching the film. Because oddly, although those things seem easier, they do not build the self as quickly. And ultimately, it's the building of consciousness for the self. That is what is the goal. So reading has that benefit. Now, some people have told me, yeah, well, I've heard you say that before, but, you know, every time I tried to read what you wrote, man, it's like crazy. You spend an hour on a sentence, and I don't know if I want to do that. And besides which, sometimes no matter how much time I spend, I can't understand what's been written. And it's frustrating. Okay, I understand that. That's certainly a worthwhile reason to look for backup. So if you read something, don't understand it, then you pick out a radio show. So maybe I'll listen to this and I'll get this, putting them both together. Go back to reading about it after I listen to his explanation. That helps. Another thing that helps is a study group where everybody is reading but then discussing what they've read and the problems they're having learning. And then if someone is actually there teaching, well, that, who actually does understand, that's even better. But that's the reason that works so well. But you've got to add the reading part in so you build the self. And I've taught study groups where people wouldn't read the material. They just come and show up, but they didn't read it. And I would push and push and push to get them to read it. The reason I would do that is because it builds the self. It changes who they are. I'm not teaching for information type. I'm teaching to build consciousness, and that requires that the person do the reading, does the reading. Even if they come to class every time, no matter how well they listen to me, it's the reading that builds the consciousness so much better. All right, so all that being said, atheism has a problem with self. So reading about things that explain God in ways that gives better understanding to the self is big, good stuff. If you use it along with radio shows or video things or books, pictures, I should say, in books, that may help. Anything that you can use is welcome to add to whatever you can read. How does atheism, then, ever get cured, we'll call it? Because once someone heads down this path, they're losing more and more of their self every day that they're alive because they're terribly afraid of death. And this is no kidding. I mean, this is such a big deal that people, once they have this terrible fear and they start denying the fear, no matter what you do to try to talk to them about it, they run away. You give them a book and say, here, read this book and you'll change your mind. I don't want to change my mind. Oh, but if you really confront them, are you afraid? Oh, no, I'm not afraid. I'll gladly talk to you next week, next year, next lifetime. Because they never come around. And it's so fascinating because ultimately it leads to incredible misery. Because suffering is the loss of consciousness, by definition, in metaphysics. And atheism leads to not only suffering, but because the person becomes less and less creative in life, now that I'll be further explicit with this, but they become less creative because the things that they do create are smaller and smaller in construct. That doesn't mean they're not creative. It just means they make things that are, or create things that have less and less to do with God, and those are the big things. Those are the things that help life to grow. So the things they create actually stifle life, including their own. And the result is the meaning in their life is diminishing daily. And so their life is not just suffering due to loss of consciousness, but it's misery because of loss of consciousness and creation. The meaning in life is sucked out of their existence. Now, I guess we get to tonight's show, A World of Misery Without God. That was after the word atheism. The ultimate goal of evil is to destroy life. And the most effective way of destroying life is to destroy the meaning in creation. Even if something stays alive, if there is no meaning to its existence, it's better off dead. Both to its own level of existence and to God. Although God doesn't kill it. But that is the strangest part of the system. Atheism leads to a life of misery. Holy cow. This is no kidding. This is a serious, serious problem. At the present time, atheism is the fastest growing non-religion, or fastest way of growing non-belief in God, which is a religion of a sort. Because it believes its existence is founded upon no faith in God, no God, nothing spiritual. Wow. All right. So, And again, these I've gone very fast on this. I know there's a lot of concepts that I've covered in a short period of time. It's been about an hour now. So here is where we're headed, though. I'm not going to leave you with this pile of crap and just say, oh, really, I'm going to sign off now and have a great life. No, there's answers for this problem. It's self-correcting to some extent. No, God isn't some mean, evil dude who just wants to create some kind of terrible existence for everybody and then have us pray to it and in some way, you know, make it happy because all the miserable people and other life forms are groveling at its feet while it does terrible things to us. That's absolutely not God. God gives free will. And the only way it can make sure that will is free, which is the choices and the consistency of our own choices, is that it doesn't force its will on us. It allows us to choose how to live and when. Now, against some beliefs, God doesn't have a plan that involves human plans. God's plan is to allow people to make their own plans, even if those plans are counter to God's thinking. It's a little hard to understand that, and some people who have strong religious beliefs otherwise may balk at it. But the reason God doesn't pre-plan things or doesn't make up its mind about exactly what's going to happen tomorrow or the next day is that it wants to have life discover the miracle of self-creation as it discovered for itself. And this is its greatest gift, which it won't take away from us. But that means when things go bad, except under extraordinary circumstances, God does not intervene. Now, what are the extraordinary circumstances that God does intervene, at least some part of God, that can be your soul or it could be an oversoul, or it could be some being that's beyond all of our imaginations. It could be, you know, a super being of some proportion. What? How do they exist if God's not interfering? Right? Wouldn't that be like God is doing the interfering? Well, here's the bottom line. Those that have the greatest level of faith in God with hope for outcomes greater than the present level, no matter how much their self tries very hard, and they know they will do that, they do the best they can, which is called nobility, and then they also, people in this category, because of their senses of God, know that ultimately, if they keep doing the best that they can, no matter how bad the outcome is at the present time, it will get better. How could they say that? Because, I mean, if God's not, you know, sort of like saying, I'm a hands-off being, well, God's not a deistic God. It didn't make the universe and just say, hey, God. It stayed, and it is within us, but only to those who are co-creators with it. So those that co-create as much as possible with God, in an immediate sense, may not get any reward for it, and may at times have terrible consequences in a short period of time, like a decade or something. I know that sounds like a lot of time, terrible, but it's nothing. Because ultimately, these people know that in the long run, they and God will prevail because God is good, life is ultimately good, and evil ultimately will defeat itself, if not be defeated by all the good things that the good people, the godly people, do. So there's an inevitability given to the hope, and that inevitability to hope cancels out the fear of death, because there is no such thing as death. People who understand God know the consciousness goes on forever because they know they're a soul. And the soul lives forever. It just becomes greater and greater and greater until someday, way, way, way beyond this universe, it will become God itself of sorts. Every being that creates good, which co-creates with God, therefore. No part of that being that does that co-creation will ever cease to exist. It's guaranteed that. People who understand God understand what I'm saying. People who understand ageless wisdom understand what I'm saying. And people who don't understand ageless wisdom, but they use their senses to create many great things for others so that others may do the same, don't even need to hear what I'm saying. They already know it. None of those people I just described are atheists. It's a mouthful. All right, so here's the interesting part of all this. The suckers, they're people that think that they're getting power or control of others, they're getting things for something for nothing, or even the ones who are just rational, believe they're living life the correct way. The people who generally today are politically called progressives are mostly rational atheists. And so, even if they pretend to go to church and other things, they don't believe in God. And they go to church maybe for a lot of reasons. Some of them are social, but most of them having to do with manipulationism, at least in how they appear to us. So the process is just, it's so amazing, but at the same time so elusive to atheists. They are the ones that are most lost. They are the ones that will suffer immensely. And if the world were to become about twice as atheistic as it is right now, that's not even the majority of the people, it would likely end. Now, why? Because after all, we're not even talking about a majority of people that are believers, etc. Why would the world end if just like a third of the world is atheistic and doesn't believe at all in God? It seems like we're close to that, right, in some places. Certainly here in the United States, it's true. But why would that be so dangerous? Because atheism eventually leads to evil. Not necessarily even in one lifetime. It may take two or three or more lifetimes for it to end up in that position. But if the third of the world, actually if only a quarter of the world, were to become evil, the world's over. How do I know that? Well, historically, the world was almost given up on during a prehistorical time in the Atlantean period. At the very end of that period, about a quarter of the Atlanteans, which was most of the population, became evil. And from the accounts of that time, the world nearly ended. Very close. We know that towards the end, but not at the end of this Atlantean period, there were only 70,000 people living outside of Atlantis. And then eventually there were only 5,000 to 10,000 after a great calamity about 72,000 years ago, 74,000 years ago. And a big volcano created a tremendous hardship on Earth. Not for the rest of the Atlanteans, but for the people living outside of that, mostly in the African area. So you have this very strange, we'll say, result. That because it takes time, and it may take several generations of time, of atheism, but it leads to darkness. It leads first to darkness and then to evil. And that's what causes the world to go, because one out of four people being evil, that's when evil becomes exponential in its growth. There's just enough people in a perfect ratio for evil to grow vastly through its use of group self, group consciousness, to overpower almost all of the remaining three quarters of the people. It works best under a plan similar to communism, and it uses some some of the communistic principles in its thought process, because evil is, and communism are similar. And you can say, well, what about socialism? Well, socialism is a part of communism that is the economic side of it. The communism is far more than just an economic system. Communism is a system of thought that requires that one believe that God doesn't exist. Now you say, well, I didn't know that. Where did you get that from? Well, from the guy who invented it. On paper, communism. Marx, well, two guys, Marx and Engels, both who were Germans. So they came up with this idea that, that you convince people that religion is used by the rich people, the powerful people in society, to convince the people who are not so rich that they should just give up everything so the rich people can take it from them, and they would be then enslaved by the rich people. The reason evil comes up with this plan is you got to blame somebody else for all the troubles that evil causes while it communizes everybody and convinces them not to believe in God, because that produces all kinds of terrible results, great misery. But you keep producing the opposite. You tell everybody, well, it's because the rich people, the rich and powerful people, have all of the things and control all of your life, and they're doing all these bad things to you, and so we have to derive some social justice for everybody by collectivizing and redistributing all wealth, and at the same time becoming powerful, more powerful, and controlling more all of the rich, that they become our slave, will enslave the rich. And of course, they manage to do this, but they're doing it, the ones that are actually doing it, the 25% eventually, are the ones who, at various levels, are the ones who have the wealth, who have everything, and then the poor ones are just enslaved. But it takes three people for every one to ultimately achieve this this result. And if you don't have at least that much, then there isn't enough people, slaves, doing the work to get enough to make opulent the life of those that want to seek and steal from them. And so it's the 25% level that's very, very dangerous. Now, I said a third. Well, when you get to the third, then at that point, the planet ends, because even evil can't maintain itself anymore. There aren't enough people to maintain the system. The system completely collapses. Evil destroys itself. Communism eventually destroys itself. Not before it doesn't destroy everything and everybody else, but it does destroy itself. So the system is almost always, in some way, we'll say, a very negative factor. Okay. So this is fascinating. Here we are, and ultimately it appears that there is a we'll call it a bottom line to atheism, and that is that atheism has been incorporated in all of the evil thought processes and designs presently being used on Earth. Now, before communism was officially a plan and a structure, the same ideas have been used for centuries, even thousands of years before that, in part. But when it was completely pieced together and made into a plan for taking over a more intellectually endowed society, it became, we'll say, the ultimate form of government, an ultimate form of evil to express itself. Before that, pieces of it were used in kingdoms and by various other, we'll say, dictators for the purpose of saying, well, I'll redistribute if you just make me the most powerful. And people believed that because they didn't feel powerful enough to work together as individual selves, and they didn't have the complete understanding of evil. So they gave it up to some small group of people, usually who had a leader of that group in charge of things. This thing does not necessarily, in and of itself, mean that all atheists are necessarily, at this moment, communists or monarchists or seeking to be even progressives in a social sense or economic sense. But most of them are headed in that direction, even if they just started. And nearly all of them will eventually end up in that if they don't correct the state of atheism in itself. Wow. And you thought that all of this was really not important. Well, it may not be, because if we don't straighten this thing out, we're going to learn it the hard way, which I'm hoping will not be the case, but anything is possible. Now, I do want to say that, you know, as I speak about these things, I am talking in generality. So please, if you are an atheist, don't think I'm condemning you to some terrible existence. I'm not doing anything. And could there be exceptions to what I'm saying? So to speak, in the narrow, small, or limited time sense, yes. I'm talking about using this as a model for one or more lifetimes, incomplete. And possibly two, three, or four lifetimes when it gets to be really a serious problem. Souls try to produce lifetimes where this doesn't repeat itself from one lifetime to the next. They sometimes are successful, and because humans have free will, even though they have a connected soul, unless they're evil, they still can choose to ignore. And they do. Wow. All right, so let's get to the solution part. We're at the midway here. Yep, right the midway. And let's talk about solutions to this. Oh, good. Because let me tell you, nobody wants to have this hanging over them. Especially if you are an atheist, recognize what I'm saying, because you don't have to stay in that position. You can change, really. Let's move into the things that change atheism. Well, atheists start off by using what was called rational thinking, oftentimes by being indoctrinated through an educational system that excludes God. Now, generally speaking, those systems promote knowledge as the highest form of what they call consciousness, knowledge. Knowledge is the big thing. More knowledge, more power. More power, more everything. That's sort of what people get sold on. But knowledge is really a very limited tool for developing consciousness. It has some value. And at the present time, in human development, it's become a very big thing. It wasn't as important centuries and certainly millennia ago. Limited knowledge did not hamper a person's consciousness development because their mental facilities were not strong enough to use greater levels of knowledge. They just couldn't use it. They wouldn't understand it because their consciousness could not grow to a level of knowledge. Now, that's not true. Each generation of human beings is improving its level of sense, giving it better information. And that increases its use of the information to create knowledge. And then the knowledge is used to create things that affect society, which are called technologies and, in some cases, other forms of development through knowledge. All of that is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But the consciousness has to exceed the amount of knowledge created, or a person starts losing meaning in life, as I described earlier in the show, and they lose their ability to sense God. The answer is to teach people, starting from preschool or whatever, about knowledge and explain how the knowledge supports their being an understanding of God, which is the heart chakra. And then eventually, as a person grows, the self starts becoming more creative, and then it can co-create things in with God, even if those things involve knowledge and technologies and anything else in the universe. It's fine. That all works. That's how to counter the ugliness of atheism, is to make sure that the knowledge that is taught in the schools is balanced with more consciousness, and specifically, and hopefully more directly, spiritual consciousness. Because knowledge without spiritual consciousness becomes reducing of self, especially higher self, over a fairly small amount of time. You can keep the smaller self pretty close to the same size for almost a whole lifetime, but you can't grow the higher self, the soul part of us, without there being enlightened creation, spiritual concepts, spiritual thought, and spiritual interactions. So, our answer is that in the educational realm, there needs to be the education that includes consciousness, to begin with, all forms of consciousness, and then spiritual consciousness specifically. Does that mean everybody should go to a religious school? No. It means that everybody needs to go to a school that recognizes the existence of God in some form or other. It doesn't have to be any specific religion. And that helps people to find all the ways that God exists in form. Those ways are the following. Each school needs to help, and I don't care what grade we're talking about. At each grade, there's a level of doing this. But each school needs to create more of, we'll call it, cooperation and sharing, so there is a greater level of intelligent interactions. Those intelligent interactions could be measured because there'll be a reduction in force and require less energy to do each action. Schools should teach this. That's the physical world, and the third part of it, way of creating more of God. Then the same schools need to teach that there are ways of giving to others. First, in some personal ways, where we'll say some people may need that, but more importantly, and absolutely a must, teach so that others can help others to still teach, give to others so that others can become better givers. That's a soul level of teaching and giving and love, and that way directly raises consciousness better than the first way I described, which is a sort of a backdoor method. So now you're directly building more consciousness because you're directly building more love. Sort of a universal love approach, okay? Also, the school needs to create levels of truth by challenging concepts through examples that don't work with the concepts that people have, so that they can more and more often find truth. And through humility, accepting that their way is not the right way, but wrong, whenever confronted with an example that doesn't fit a concept, the person then develops what is known as wisdom. Wisdom is the ability to be humble with the truths that are created so that you react to the creation of every truth with the understanding that at some point there'll be a greater truth to be found. That allows a person to eventually join the love part of themselves with the wisdom part of themselves. And they develop love wisdom, which is the greatest level of virtue that can be created in a mental sense. And the greatest, we'll call it spiritual foundation a person can have in relating to God in a mental way is to be humble under the most adverse of personal losses and circumstances, and to treat every truth as a temporary position of understanding. Then you have wisdom. And with the wisdom, you are able to then see God in almost every aspect through your mental mind. Seeing God mentally breaks through what is called the third tier, or the personal spiritual part of yourself, into the soul part. It puts you more directly in contact with the soul. If school's taught in this way, and I don't care what level of school of education we're talking about, it can be applied to any grade, the results would be that the world would have very low levels of atheism and much greater levels of meaning in life for all those people who go to those schools. What about socially progressive people who don't want to go to those kinds of schools because they don't believe in God? That's okay. There's no reason to force people who are atheists to believe in God. If enough people gain enough understanding of God and continue to grow in their understanding of God and to participate in the co-creation of God, atheists, by examining the life of people who do that, will realize those people's lives are free from fear and far more meaningful than the lives that they're having. Even if they still doubt the existence of God, it's a tremendous encouragement to open up their minds more and maybe to change school at the same time. Why is it so important that we only send our children to schools that are like what I just said? Because that virtually guarantees, as long as it's reinforced in the family, and starts in the family, by the way, that they will turn out not being atheists. But if it's missing in the family, and the family is the first structure that it has to be present in, and then if the child is sent to school and elects to go to schools, maybe later, like higher levels of schooling, education, then their chances of becoming atheists are very high, virtually certain in some circumstances. That's a terrible outcome because they're being saddled with a life that will eventually be meaningless, with high levels of suffering, can lead to a world of misery. Just a terrible, terrible outcome. And this is the beginning of where the problem is. It's in the family and in education. I took education first because education is easier for people to buy than what I'm going to say about families, which is coming. So if you can understand what I'm saying there about the educational process, and that makes sense to you, and you're starting to say, well, maybe we should send our kids to here or there. And if you can't send your kids to any school because of some laws or regulations or something that does what I suggest, get the heck out of there. Go wherever you have to go to get free. All right, so let's talk about family. This is a very touchy subject because most people believe that their family is sacrosanct to themselves, and they bring up their kids the way they feel like you bring them up. And if they are already atheists, why should they ever consider bringing God into the picture because they believe in atheism? If you are an atheist, and if your spouse is an atheist, if you have one living with you, then let me suggest this. Try to open your mind to the possibility that maybe your children deserve the option to deny God that you've already taken. And by having that option, you give them a great gift. I'm not saying that you force them to believe in God, nor do you force them to be atheists. The better way of approaching this is to give them every opportunity to see and understand God, and if they can find it, all the more for them, and if they can't, so be it. Recognize that atheism is an actual damning way of existence. It's a horrible position to be in. Why would you want your children to be there? It doesn't free you. It makes you fearful and miserable. So give them the opportunity to find God, and maybe you'll find some of that yourself, even through your children. So families need to be open-minded to this question of God. How do you do that if you're an atheist, if both parents are an atheist? Well, you do it because if you're just at the beginning stages of rational atheism, you believe that other people have at least the right to think differently. And those people could even be your children. That is at least a better place to be than going, if you're further down the road, you got to control them. They have to be just like you, because it threatens you if they aren't. Well, that's a terrible position. Now, you can say, well, let's reverse tables. So you wouldn't mind having kids that just decide to be atheists. Well, I would agree that I would be humble and help my children in every way possible to find God, but at the same time, choose not to. The point is that the chances that they wouldn't find God are very, very small if they're really allowed to use all their senses, and they're brought up in a way in which they are loving and giving in ways that are more like souls, by example, not by just some teaching thing. Because while schools are the educational model, the family is the model of doing. Children learn what they live. Living is what happens in the family. Education of knowledge applied and sometimes spiritually endowed can happen in school. So this is the team that I suggest is the best. Have a family that works, hopefully, in a way that provides hope to their children by believing strongly in God and by presenting their sense of what their understanding of God is, literally on a moment-to-moment daily basis, so that you're living it, the child and children are living it, and they can choose to reject it. They can choose not to accept it. But at least they'll have the experience of living in part. And maybe children do have to have some doubt, because the doubt teaches them the suffering of not having faith in God. It gives them some will say, right to even make a terrible mistake, which is okay. Because you can't be creative without accepting that creation itself has the built-in factor of making mistakes. That's what happens. It's all right. As long as a person continues to create meaning in their life in the long run, the short-term pain and small amount of suffering that a mistake can have can lead to much greater levels of meaning later, and the removal of the suffering from before. So it's not a terrible thing, and it can be a wonder. And children that are brought up with this understanding have tremendous capabilities, in general, to lead highly spiritual lives that grows more of God than most of us. Their life takes on tremendous rich meaning, limits suffering, and gives them a sense of immortality. The greatest gift is the sense of immortality and of God that comes through this system. The greatest sorrow comes through a life of atheism. There's nothing at the end of that life for that person. Oh, yes, they eventually go on and live in the astral world and say, whoops, guess I was wrong about that one. I did some astral traveling, as some of you know, many years ago, long time ago, half of my lifetime ago. And when I did, I met people on the other side who used to be physically alive. And some of them were atheists. And, I mean, they were. But when I got to the other side, most of them were not. Even the ones that were very strongly atheistic. And I said, well, why are you no longer atheists? And many told me over time, because I did this for a period of time, these travels, many told me that, well, it's very simple. Here it's so obvious that God exists. Because there is a, we'll say, preponderance of sense here that God is around. On Earth, it was drowned out by the physicalness, the tremendous slowness and problems of and forces of life, so that I didn't get it until I got here. And that's even in some of the lower subworlds, where you would think many people who were obviously atheists in their physical life exist, but they still have changed their thought about it. It doesn't mean they've changed their style of living, by the way. Just because you know God exists now doesn't mean that you fully support the idea that God is wonderful and great, because after all, you're still no good yourself, so how could God be? Of course, over time, that is mellowed by people eventually coming to grips with the ideas that created their own life. God was just the giver of the choice, not the decider of the outcome. It was amazing, because I met some people who were very spiritual in some very relatively higher realms, who were dismayed because they always believed in God, but the God that they believed in was a more deterministic God that had a whole structure of a religion that it served or presided over the followers of that religion. And I guess in their mind, ignored the rest of the folks. I don't know. Yeah. And I actually met people like this who were so dejected and sorrowful, at least initially, upon their arriving in the astral world, usually in a higher astral world, and not able to fathom why the tenets of their religion and the philosophies and ideas of their religion aren't panning out to be true in this heaven that they think they're in, because all the things that they think they know about God are not really the way God seems to be when you take away all of the physical consequences of physical earth life. This is no small change. And some of these folks have as hard a time, or harder, accepting a more expansive and, we'll say, universal idea of God, especially in terms of love, than the ones that they had in regards to the particular church they belong to. It's no small thing. Religion was a very big part of their lives in some circumstances, and yet, just like the atheists, sometimes worse, in the next realm, they're faced with having to give up that God for a more bigger concept of God. But the bigger concept has with it a less personal approach. It's more spiritual by any stretch of the imagination, but less personal. It doesn't deal with the personal side. You're not going to get more things of that God. You may not get even things that are intangible. You have a better opportunity to co-create with God in the astral world. Much better. One problem. There's no material things, and you don't have a physical body or an electrical magnetic part or etheric part of that body. It's gone. So the place where God is most difficult, but also the place where it could take, would take the most creation, most creativity to create in, is the physical world. And it's no longer accessible to these people. And so then people start realizing and even regretting what they've lost. And it's that regret that becomes part of their soul. And it's the reason people choose to reincarnate. And yet they know when they reincarnate, most of them will have little or no memory of their prior lifetimes. Because they didn't create enough good things that were connected together to remember. If you create a lot of good things, co-create with God, a lot of good things, but they don't connect together, because one doesn't lead to the next, etc., then you don't end up with continuity of consciousness, and so you can't remember it in your next lifetime. You even tend to forget it as you move into the mental world in that life, the lower mental world. So it's a very difficult thing, and it's fascinating how it all works. It truly is. Now, this isn't a punishment, by the way. The lack of consciousness that leads to a loss of memory is the same lack of consciousness that leads to the eventual development of atheism. And so there's a common factor. This is an amazing part of ageless wisdom. It is not punishment. It is the result of our own, we'll say, selfish creations. We isolate ourselves from one lifetime to the next, not being able to enjoy that which was created in goodness or in God in the last lifetime, because we didn't do it enough to connect to the next and the next and the next interaction. So the memories don't retain themselves. This has been proven. You've got to have 60% retention in connection of memories or interactions to be able to remember anything. Wow. You really need 50% and then about 10% more in order to be able to reconnect the connections. So, whatever. But that's the amazing part of it, that this has actually scientifically been discovered, and it was done so a long time ago in the 1950s. So, it's actually an accepted concept in many parts of psychology. All right. Well, when you don't have enough of your memories from prior lifetimes, yourself has to struggle to rebuild itself in each new lifetime, and it's always a bit behind and has a lot of trouble. That also leads to an increase in the incidence of atheism. Having schools and families work together to counter that effect could lead to a person developing more and more continuity in their connection of creating good things, leading to extremely meaningful lifetimes, especially the one we're in right now. It's entirely possible just by those two elements that I've described to make a big change in this problem. Now, let's talk about politics for a little bit. The politics of liberal progressivism, which is really founded much closer to socialism and eventually into parts of communism, those connections are, we'll say, the result of the progression in itself of rational thought. Rational thinking is not bad because it means that a person is trying to find logic that supports their thinking structure. But logic is strictly a lower mind part of life, part of existence. Higher concepts are not necessarily logical until a person is able to comprehend most of the concepts. The higher concepts are huge. They include hundreds of thousands of smaller concepts, and they fit millions and millions of examples and thought forms. So the result is that these huge, big concepts sometimes are difficult for people to grasp. You have to develop a higher consciousness. Knowledge will not get you there. All the knowledge in the world will not give a person the ability to create larger concepts. Some people believe that more knowledge gives them that ability. It doesn't, but they think it can, and so they promote that to others, and they also seek it by studying things for the sake of knowledge alone, without being creative in anything new, usually. And also, the most important thing, not getting bigger concepts, but smaller ones. That's the reductio absurdum. You keep moving into smaller and smaller ways of thinking in order to preserve the rational way of thinking. You become a smaller self in the process. It's terrible. Now, progressivism has to do with the development of the lower mind and the smaller part of the higher mind, that they're linked together and karma monastically connected to the astral body. It means that the astral desires come first. And so a person won't think about something unless it fits their desires. And things that don't fit their desires, they just ignore. We'll forget about that. And instead, they center on the things that they desire to prove the rationality of that particular correctness or truth. It's not only not truth, it's oftentimes completely twisted and made up in order to fit the needs of their emotional body. Whoa. It destroys the ability to be empathic because a person, when they're so driven by their own desires, their feelings don't work for other people. They can't feel what other people are feeling. They only feel these super strong glamours or desires inside themselves. Then you don't have any empathy. But empathy for others is what develops the eventual connection with the higher self. And without it, we don't connect to our soul. So empathy is critical. Empathy is the use of all the senses of the astral body in a way that is not driven by desire and that is balanced among all seven of the centers, with the two spiritual centers balancing the five centers of form equally. When you do that, you have amazing empathy. It's called super empathy. It's super empathy because the super part comes from the two spiritual senses, and when it's balanced with the regular empathy, then you've got super empathy in a balanced sense. Amazing. Amazing. Now, in ancient wisdom, sometimes super empathy only means just the two spiritual senses, but I use the idea, or I present the idea, that the purity of the super empathy is where it could be used, and it can't be used until it's joined with the balanced five senses of astral feeling. So your five senses of astral feeling are joined with your two senses, super senses, of God in terms of love. You join all these different ways of loving together and you make sure they're balanced. And that's real super empathy. That's what is so critical and so critically needed to help people to understand God. It also challenges the thing I talked about earlier called the karma monastic or desire-ridden thought of the astral body. It forces the desires to leave the person and become more loving. Forces it. It uses the very force of the drives, we'll call it, or driven parts, the what I refer to as glamours, other people might just call them super strong desires. It takes those and the desire to co-create with God becomes more important than having these other desires. When that takes place, the desires themselves, the energy in them, is used to co-create with God, and you get rid of the connection of the drives or the desires completely driving the mental body. And I was thinking, using our quote-unquote rational minds to fudge and pretend and to lie to ourselves what truth is, just so we can live our lives by being social progressives or economic progressives or both, by wanting to control others for their own good, for the good of God, if God is in their picture, or for the good of seeing that God doesn't exist, but after all, someone has to replace God if God doesn't exist. It takes good people to do that. Of course, those good people want to enslave others, but it's for their own good. Those other people want to make sure that they tell them what to eat, what to sleep, who and what kind of health care they need, how to take care of their children, what kind of education their children are going to get. And every other aspect of their life, control becomes the operative word in a political sense. Why is it so disturbing that we have a movement in the United States and many other countries towards this progressivism? Is that it is really the surface issue that leads deeper into darkness and evil. Most progressive people are not evil, because most people are not evil. But most progressive people are open, on occasion, to being influenced by evil, and almost never can see evil. The greatest danger of progressivism is that it blinds people to evil. They think evil is a result of a social condition which they can control and change, if people will just do what they tell them. And there'll be no such thing as evil. It's just a bad childhood, you know. And equivocation becomes another hallmark in the progressive world. It's just as good to do things that are against God, but gives freedom to people, than not. Why? Because freedom is a good thing, and everybody should have it. Even if you're giving them freedom that poisons them with communism, reduces their overall self-structure by leading them into personality-disordered thoughts and behaviors. Drugs are part of that. In some people, and with some people's actions, it can be homosexuality. Homosexuality is not evil. Homosexuality is actually a result of becoming too self-focused in one's own sexuality. And oddly, it cancels out the desire to connect with someone of the other sex. And it's a kind of strange thing to have happen. But it happens frequently, because a person is more concerned about what stimulates their desires than the desire to truly give them up. I know homosexuals sometimes love each other, don't they? Yes, they do. But they can't express that love through the act of sexuality. But that's a whole mechanical nightmare that I don't want to get into tonight. But it is true. And nonetheless, we ignore that. The solution for it is to bring people up in a godly world. And in a political sense, progressivism and the eventual leading to, unfortunately, socialism and communism also leads to increases in drug use and homosexuality and a number of other personality disorder-driven interactions. It is an unfortunate problem. It doesn't mean that there aren't other issues or causes for some of the factors here, but you need to realize that in a world as complex as the one that we presently exist in. One, to have politically one thing that could do so much darkness and be so incredibly destructive in a relatively short period of time, that's very scary. That means it's very powerful, even if it's not good. And we should be concerned about the power that a progressive political system has in terms of being able to be destructive to the self-development and eventually to the higher self-development. It does both of them. All right, so most progressives, the majority actually, have a leaning towards atheism. Some of them are agnostic, or they don't know. But why are they moving more in that direction than just becoming progressive but very strongly, we'll say, spiritual? Well, there are a few that are like that, but they're rare, believe it or not. They exist, though. The main reason why the majority aren't is because progressivism wants to control others, and God wants to give freedom to everybody. And that's the antithesis. So by its very nature, there's a cross purpose at the very foundation of the political system we call progressivism and of spirituality, which is the mind of God in our world. So it's a terrible kind of consequence. And there are not a lot of answers in terms of being able to accept the progressivism and say, well, we'll just bring it in and kind of make it part of the normal way of it. So we'll have a bunch of progressive people, it's not a problem. Well, that doesn't bear out to be true historically, but more importantly, it doesn't make much sense either from what I'm teaching about tonight. You see, those who choose to, in some basic way, be the antithesis, the opposite in concept, of God in the most fundamental of ways, which includes governance and many other factors, education, family development, so forth, those things are the basis of most people's life. Especially progressivism, when it involves itself, as it so often does, in political terms, because it makes sure it involves itself in life outside of politics, and God does the reverse. How do I know that? Because the founders of the United States followed the practice of Freemasonry, at least a good portion of it. And the other ones who were not in the Freemasonry were, give or take, whether they were Federalists or not, whether they were into more strong centralized government or not, they all seemed to be towards the libertarian side of thought. Libertarianism espouses the first premise of God. The growth of life ultimately first must be free to create itself. Remove that and you've removed God. You can't say, well, we'll make up for it. We'll have social justice. We'll make sure everybody gets anything they need. And blah, blah, blah. It doesn't work. It can't work because if you remove the first part of God, the second part of God's mind, which is universal love, can't exist because it isn't wise. You get into unwise giving, which harms everybody. Unwise giving is giving to those who not only don't deserve to be given to, but use the giving to be harmful to further their own and others' own selfishness. It's absurd, but it's the truth. And then finally, the third part of God's mind, spiritual is the first two parts of God's mind, which is thought. But the third part of God's mind is the interactions need to be allowed to take place where there is the ability to make mistakes and the freedom to create things, things are part of the energy world, that may or may not be of benefit to others as well as to yourself. In a progressive viewpoint, the giving of, the exchanges and the interactions of people is controlled by the government. And the government decides what can or can't be created, what can and can't be exchanged or sold. We talk about buying and selling, it's a really exchange of energies. And it goes so far as to declare that the bodies of people are owned and controlled by the government. And in fact, by the way, Obamacare that says that in its new form, as it exists now. Obamacare says that because the government is paying for health care, it has a right to tell and force people to eat, sleep, do whatever is necessary to maintain the levels as associated with the government's viewpoint of health as it decides. That's pretty dangerous. It's the most intrusive form of government that can be done. And it removes the most amount of freedom in one act than anything, any other one thing that could have been done. It's why the present president, who is a massive progressive, chose to do that better than anything else. Because the agenda is not, it's not to win elections, or it's to control. Which is the opposite of God. Control life. We have a system that we're fighting right now in this country with and about that is very dangerous. So politically speaking, there is a whole lot to be said about why the present elements of politics that are bolstered by progressivism leads to atheism and is going to eventually lead to the destruction of whatever country it takes hold of, and eventually the world itself. How do we get over this political problem? Well, the people that know better need to stand up and let others gain some understanding of where this is all going to. So far, the Republicans have done a very bad job of that. Some of their members could have done a better job than they chose to do, but the actual people who stood in the way were not the progressives as much, even though they lie about a lot of stuff, say a lot of things against Republicans. They say some things that are true, too, by the way. The Republicans' problem is that they have tenets that are still progressivism. I know it sounds strange. Oh, I thought the Republicans were all non-progressive. No, that's not true. About a third of Republicans are progressives. They just want to be progressive in a more right-wing way, using some conservative principles applied, but still want to control the people through government. And some of the control is by being compassionate to people who don't deserve compassion, or give to people who don't deserve to be given to. This pretty much started with the Bush, two different Bushes, and it literally progressed, and it led into Obama. The issues here are not that one particular party is better than any other party. It's that progressivism part of politics in Israel. Who are the people who are least progressive? It tends to be some of the libertarians. But the thing is that we need another name for a party that is into God. And a lot of people say, well, you can't combine God in politics because, you know, the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, and the Magna Carta. But the thing is that that's not true. That's not true. The government shall make no concepts that other people have to follow about God. I absolutely, 100% behind that one. What I'm talking about is that we need freedom to gain understanding about God and freedom to co-create with God, including the freedom to choose not to, as a part of all the politics that we're doing. That is simply not happening. It's not. All right, so moving into the next area, because I'm looking at my time here, I want to make sure I cover the things that are most important right now, but there are a lot of things that I'm not going to be able to get to. Okay, moving into the next area of importance, let's talk about the ability of free markets. Why are free markets so important? Because free markets promote the principle of the third part of God's mind. They build the economy very effectively, by the way. And when you prevent the one beast, one bad thing of free markets, which is monopoly, when you prevent monopoly, and you do so in a way which is very even-handed, and it makes sense, you've got a great system. Because then you don't have any bullies. You don't have any one business that controls everything. And it's perfectly reasonable to have capitalism and free markets and still have an anti-monopoly policy. There's no reason you can't do both. I realize we go back 100 years ago, and before that, there were some people who argued, well, we destroy capitalism, we get rid of monopolies, that's when everybody has to have the ability to make as much as they want. I'm not saying to limit someone's ability to earn money. I'm saying to prevent people from stopping others from being able to do the same. It's not about one person being able to be creative. It's about one person preventing others from being creative by practices that produce forces, either economic or social or political forces, that are applied to people from the wealth gained by the person who has been in business better and longer than others. All right, so we need a free market system. Why are free markets so important? Because the first principle of God is that we've got to be free. And you've got to have freedom. Now, socialism is an attempt by the government to intervene in free markets. It does so by controlling major industries, like healthcare. And healthcare is one of the largest industries in the world, right? And so once you get into controlling industries, that you say, well, we're not controlling the small industries. They can still do whatever they want. Well, that's not true, because when you control major industries, then the government is the monopoly. And bad things happen. The government picks winners and losers. The government allows the people who stroke it by giving political monies and corruption and graft and all kinds of patronage takes place. It means you get jobs from the government and other stuff. All of that is a system of just corruption. Socialism is the foundation of corruption. It can only work in a very small country where everybody is watching carefully the government, and the government changes frequently from one person being empowered to another, like almost on a yearly basis, that you could have that kind of socialism, if you want to call it that. It actually works up to a few million people. It works best at a few hundred thousand person level, like a city-state sort of thing. You get too much bigger than a few million, and no socialistic process will work, because the people lose control over what's going on, and the corruption is inevitable. All right, well, that's not the worst thing, but it gets worse. Because eventually, the next step, beyond socialism, is to introduce communism, or some form of communism. What is communism? Communism is where no one effectively owns anything, and all businesses effectively are a part of the government. All businesses are in some way collectivized, and all wealth is redistributed based upon the government's decision on who shall have what, based upon the needs that they have, but based upon, first, the need the government has. This is really evil. It's just a hidden form of evil. And it's way worse than socialism, because instead of controlling just most of free markets through government monopoly, you now control every element of economic exchanges between all people on all levels on a daily basis. And effectively, nobody really owns anything. Most of what anybody would say they own, the government could come and take and redistribute to someone, by its standards, more deserving. This is the true meaning of slavery. The entire society becomes enslaved to the few in government who control the government. And that's the real foundation of a dictatorship, and also of an anti-democracy. Almost all communist states claim they are both democratic and even a republic. None of them are truly democratic, and all of them are evil. We are on the road to become communist right now, so to speak. The President of the United States is actually a colonial-type communist. You don't know what that is, but I want to get a copy of the movie 2016 and watch that movie. And listen to what President Obama's brother says about him. The most important thing to recognize about communism is that it always says white is black or black is white. It always says that up is down and left is right, and it confuses everybody, because it knows that if it said the absolute truth about what it was doing and why, nobody would go for it. So it has to constantly do a dance. And the dance is to convince everybody that it's something it's not, and that it can do something that it can't do, and that it will achieve something that is the opposite of what it's attempting to do. It's sinister at best, and horribly malevolent under normal circumstances. How do we get this way? Where is it that we're coming from that we constantly fall into this business? And, of course, I did a program that's called Something for Nothing, The Road to Darkness. Okay, what is it? There's a nature in human beings. We'll call it laziness, but what it really is a fear of death that comes from a lack of understanding God and a lack of belief in God. That position, that we'll call it weakness, causes people to want to get something for nothing because they don't see a really bright future. They fear death. And to deny the fear of death, they seek to get something for nothing and feel better about a shrinking self that they have. Their shrinking self, this is a curse. Again, it's a world of misery. The misery leads to more and more loss of self and more suffering. Communism plays on that. It seeks to use that as its big advantage. People want something for nothing. Let's give it to them. Even though the something is in exchange for their very existence to enslave them, to remove the very thing they need, which is God, to tell them God is the opiate of the masses, the comment by Marx and Engels. And it's a silly thing because your rational mind tells you it can't be true. But if all of that is the truth, who wants to live here anyway? If this is all there is it really worth anything? So something for nothing becomes the phrase, and it's used in the word the euphemisms today are social justice and redistribution of wealth. Those are the synonyms for something for nothing. And the people who get more out of the process by the redistribution, and the people who get more self-worth temporarily because they're being given stuff and because they're being told by the government they are more important, see? You poor folks are very important to us. Even you middle-class folks that are sort of on the lower side, you're really important to us. Just all we want is your vote. That's how it works. It's sort of like massive patronage. Give somebody something that is almost worthless, but tell them it's absolutely free. All you have to do is just give up your soul. God. Isn't that a good exchange? Isn't that worth it? I don't think so. So atheism is the hallmark of this whole situation. Atheism is the branding to move eventually into evil. Are all atheists evil? Absolutely not. Are most atheists evil? No. But will most evil people, are most evil people atheists? Absolutely. Up to the exceptions that I gave. And will most atheists over time, usually more than a lifetime is needed, become dark? Yes. And if given enough time, will they become evil? Yes. So tonight's show really gives us some pause to consider these messages. It gives us some understanding of what and how we can do to make some differences. Now, let me tell you what I have planned. One of the biggest issues right now, to me, is something, a tool that could be used by families and schools to teach a little bit about ageless wisdom to like four-year-olds and older. So I'm going to create a book in the next few months called Why Life Is for Children. And it's just going to be mostly a pictorial representation of God's plan of giving freedom and love wisdom to those who choose to accept it by sensing it and co-participating eventually with it, and the magic of that for youngsters to see. It's going to be simplistic, but some adults will probably read it and say, hey, yeah, I got it finally. couldn't read your other books. They didn't make any sense to me. But this one I got. Maybe it was written for a four-year-old, but it sure helps. Yeah, it's going to be 4 years old and up, which means that parts of it will be too much for some four-year-olds. But that doesn't matter. There'll be something they can get out of it, something maybe an eight-year-old can get out of it, or a 12-year-old. And I may have to write another one of these that goes beyond a certain age so that the older children and teenagers might find it more valuable. But the point is that we need something like this, and I haven't found it so far. I found some books that talk about God for kids. And I found one or two that bring some angels' wisdom principles into it. But most of them just aren't getting the point. And the point is that you've got to sense God to understand and to create more of God in yourself and in others. You got to do that. It's the beginning. And the sense comes from within, not from, well, just do what I say. It's even worthwhile to instruct kids on attempting to do things that might be a little hard for them to do. They might make mistakes. That's okay, right or not fatal or anything like that. And this is the point. We need more of this than we need more video games with people killing each other, more violence depicted in every aspect, and more sexuality that is either lewd or purely homosexual or has within itself a depiction of something that destroys rather than constructs love in each of the participants. These are the things that make a difference. If we don't do this sort of stuff, and I'm just going to throw my hat in the ring only because I think it's needed, but if we don't do these sorts of things, in the very near future, we're going to be facing a dilemma that is far greater than anything we ever imagined could happen, particularly here in the United States, where if you do live here, you already know what's going on. And if you live elsewhere, it's happening where you are, too. Maybe it's gotten worse there than here in your particular case. We have solutions. The solutions are for each of us to stand up and start making it known that, hey, we have answers and we are willing to do something to make a change. Now, I do not believe that there is any way to achieve the results I'm talking about, especially about atheism, through any violence or through any form of force, unless someone is trying to do violence or force directly on you, then you have a right to self-protect. But protecting yourself doesn't mean you have a right to go out and force any other selves to change who aren't trying to harm you. Some people say, well, I'm so mad I can do anything. I say, well, that's not really probably going to solve the problem, and it will definitely make it worse. And remember this. The solutions that each of us have are unique to us. So no person can fill in the gap for all the other folks. Everybody on this planet, everybody in this universe, is an individual first. We all have souls that work together, and there is a form of group soul consciousness that is God, not the evil God, but it's based upon individuality. Each of us is here to co-create uniquely, individually with God, and you can't do that when they redistribute everything that you have. And you can't do that when you're told to do everything the way someone or some group of other people decided for you to do it. Then you have the destruction of God, the destruction of virtue, and the introduction of ugliness, suffering, and misery throughout the entire world. The individual has to be a single force of good, never of evil. The individual is the process that God chose for this to take place. And the amount that we are asked in some places to give is somewhere in the 10% plus range. But my suggestion is that you consider this. Giving is not a zero-sum game. Every time you give, you receive more back than you gave, if you give wisely. And every time you create three times or more what you expend. Giving and creation are the hallmarks of beingness with meaning. And it's through finding meaning in life that, as examples of it, all of us that can be the answer will provide for all those that are presently lost. Not force of will, not even voting in the right person or not. Although that is definitely important, and some of you didn't vote in the last election, and I think you may regret that. But the point is that in each case, we all have to take individual responsibility and not say, well, how can I do? Each person can do far more than they're doing right now and do it in unique ways that nobody else can do. So every individual becomes as important in a godly sense as the others. We all have great parts of ourselves, yeah. Those cells are the higher parts of us that are connected to our soul and then express the kinds of things that truly are godly so others can see God. You want to get rid of atheism? Do that. Be the example of what is wrong with atheism by creating good, by doing it in ways that are unique and yet amazingly effective. The more creative, the more effective, even if it doesn't involve huge amounts of money or even a great amount of time. In some circumstances, there are some things that can be done by even the most, we'll call it, humble of people. Those that have what they think to be the least amount can give in amazingly great ways to make the changes necessary to move us towards a world of meaning, of universal love, and incredible connection to God. We all have that as our future if we make it that way. It is our choice. I hope you have gotten that from tonight's show. And I hope that tonight's show hasn't been a bunch of, we'll say, negative sides of things. I talk about the negative, but only to exaggerate or improve, I shouldn't say exaggerate, but increase the positive and make the positive into the true way, the true path. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.